Thanks for joining us for the Wednesday edition of Political Rewind. It's 2:06. I'm Bradley George, filling in for Bill Nigut this afternoon at the GPB studios in Midtown Atlanta. Thanks for listening to us on GPB Radio. Thanks also if you're watching on Facebook. We're on Facebook Live. If you're not, you can check us out right now on the GPB News Facebook page. And if you've got something to say about what we're talking about, if you've got a question or comment, you can tweet us at PoliticsGPB. And if you want to see the show happen in person, you can do that tomorrow night. We'll be in Macon, 7 o'clock at the Mercer University Medical School Auditorium. There are a few seats left. You can get tickets. They are free tickets, and they are available at gpb.org/community. Again, that's gpb.org/community. to see Political Rewind live in Macon tomorrow night. Joining us today are Greg Bluestein, political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, immigration attorney Charles Cook, state representative Mary Margaret Oliver, a Democrat from Decatur, and Republican strategist Julianne Thompson. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
And great to be here. As always, there's a lot to talk about, and as always, there's something that we hadn't planned to talk about that pops up in the few hours before the show. And today, that is the news about House Speaker Paul Ryan. And Paul Ryan announced this morning that he is not going to run for re-election. He says that's a personal decision.
This really was two things. I have accomplished much of what I came here to do, and my kids aren't getting any younger. And if I stay, they're only going to know me as a weekend dad, and that's just something I consciously can't do. And that's really it right there.
So Paul Ryan says this is about his family. He says it's a personal decision, doesn't have anything to do with the Trump administration, anything about the political climate right now. Julianne Thompson, what do you think is going on here?
I think that he is Speaker of the House, and if there is a good time to retire and go into the professional sector, it is when you're on top. And he's on top right now, and I think it's a good time for him to retire, especially at a time that he sees that the Republican Party is kind of in disarray right now, deciding which way it's going to go. And I think he sees it going more in the Trump direction than in his direction. So,
and what kind of struggle, fight, whatever you want to call it, does this set up in terms of, number one, for who succeeds him as Speaker if Republicans hold on to the House come January of next year? And number two, just sort of the overall direction of the GOP and who's leading it.
Sure. Well, I think that the Republicans are going to hold on to the House, although I do think it's going to be by a slimmer majority. So I think that it's going to be very important for Republicans to pick a speaker who can appeal to all of the factions within the party, someone who is close to other leadership and to the more moderate wing, as well as to the Freedom Caucus. So I think it's important to also choose someone that has a good relationship with the president as well. I like Steve Scalise. I think that he is a front-runner name that we're hearing right now, along with Kevin McCarthy, but we'll see as time goes on. I've also heard Jim Jordan.
Steve Scalise, representative from Louisiana, who was shot in this attack during a softball practice last year.
Yes.
Spent many, many months recovering in the hospital. Greg Bluestein, we have to remember as well, going back to 2015, this is not a job that Paul Ryan wanted in the first place.
No, but he has now been able to get his top priority for the job, which was the tax cut plan that passed over the winter. And so now that he has that, I guess he has sort of leeway to leave and to move on. But what I'll be interested in watching is how this affects Georgia politics. You have, as was mentioned, Scalise and McCarthy being maybe the two perceived front runners. Well, Tom Graves is close, I think, especially with McCarthy. He's going after a House Appropriations job, committee chair that he's sort of seen as a long shot for. Well, this could help him. At the same time, Doug Collins, who's now the number five Republican in the U.S. House, he might have better standing to go after judicial committee chairmanship, depending on who gets this new speaker gig. So you're already seeing jockeying within the Republican Party in Georgia over what the delegation can vote as a package, who they might line up behind.
So there's that jockeying going on. What sort of reaction, though, have we seen to the news that Paul Ryan's going to step down?
Not nearly the sort of reaction we saw over John Boehner, who seemed like a more controversial figure within the GOP, than Paul Ryan, to put it lightly. A lot of messages of gratitude, of thanks for his service, of good well wishes, and of course hopes that Republicans from Republicans that they keep that seat in Wisconsin, because that is not a easy battle to retain that seat. That puts another very competitive. It was already competitive. Now it's even more competitive.
And I saw Larry Sabato, the Institute of Politics at the University of Virginia. They rank seats for their competitiveness, and they put this seat this morning as soon as Paul Ryan announced that he's not going to run. It's now they see it as a competitive seat. Julianne, you want to jump back in here?
I did. I wanted to add to what Greg said when he talked about how it's going to affect Georgia. Also, Rob Woodall is being looked at as chairing as the chairman of rules. So I think it's going to be important to see how Georgia supports who they support.
So it's interesting. I've signed up for the email list of the various gubernatorial candidates just to kind of keep an eye on what's the message that they're pushing out to their supporters. And I got a message this afternoon from Stacey Abrams, and it says, if the most powerful Republican in Congress is afraid of losing his seat in November, a seat he won by 35 points, no Republican politician is safe. Mary Margaret Oliver, are Democrats as jubilant, or are you as jubilant about Paul Ryan stepping aside as Stacey Abrams seems to be?
I tend to be pretty cautious about predicting the future. I obviously think that Speaker Ryan was an important, popular leader who had enormous fundraising capabilities for the rest of the year, that I think that is taken away substantially by him stepping back. I also take him at his word that it's a personal decision. As I look at the young family members, young fathers and mothers on the House floor that have children at home who are weekend parents only for 3 or 4 months, I can understand or experience with them the pain of missing your children's lives. So I take him at his word, and it's always, most importantly, a personal decision whether somebody comes or goes from politics. The raw politics of it, though, are bad for the Republicans. It can't be good that they are now a gap in leadership, a gap in fundraising capacity, and yet another seat that is perceived to be at play. It's clear there are many seats at play. It's clear that there's going to be a change in the numbers, and glee at the end of a reasonably strong and successful political career would not be my first emotion.
Julianne, does this the fact that Ryan is making this announcement so early in the year, does it put pressure on Republicans to make these leadership decisions now rather than, say, after the November elections?
Well, I think so. I mean, I think that it is very incumbent on Republicans to come to some sort of consensus. You certainly don't want to have a fight going into November. And I think it's a good idea for them to come together and decide who that they're going to back at this time. I read an article earlier today where Scalise said, you know, I don't want to challenge Kevin for something. We're too good of friends. But the calls for Scalise to run for speaker are overwhelming within the party right now. So maybe it's McCarthy that doesn't plan on running. I mean, we'll see what happens, but they have some time to decide.
It's not realistic that this would be a non-competitive event. I think there are divisions within the Republican Party, clearly, that are problematical. So this decision is not going to be an easy one in my guesstimate.
Oh, and Paul Ryan had to make the decision this soon, partly because of his own primary. Yep. He only has one Republican opponent, and that person has white nationalist tendencies, anti-Semitic sayings, all that. So I think Republicans want to find a very good challenger to go up against one of the two top Democrats running for that seat. And both the Democrats, one of them, Iron Stash, has raised millions upon millions of dollars. And there's another candidate, too, who has her own loyal base. So that's going to be a very interesting race.
His name is not actually Iron Stash. That's just his
That's his nickname.
Right.
That's his Twitter handle.
Charles Cook, one of the things that Paul Ryan has not been able to do is he's not been able to get Republicans to coalesce around some sort of deal, either on DACA or a broader agreement on immigration. What do you see? Number one, what were some of the missed opportunities or failures on that front? And number two, what do you see as the opportunities for his successor going forward?
Well, from our perspective, having followed this issue in Congress for many years on immigration, there was zero chance that the House was going to vote on any immigration bill at all. They simply don't agree within the Republican Party. The question now is, does this free up Ryan to have a vote on some of these issues? Boehner said that his biggest regret as Speaker was not having the vote on immigration prior to him stepping down. There was clearly votes to pass it. There are clearly votes today in the House of Representatives to pass DACA. There's at least 40 Republicans that would vote for a clean DACA bill, and every Democrat would. It would pass tomorrow. And if it passed in the House, it would go over and pass in the Senate without a doubt. The question becomes, does Ryan really want that as part of his legacy? He is not retiring from politics for life. He's 48 years old or 47 years old. He's going to be back at some point. Does he want to be the guy that solved immigration and got Trump his wall? Because I think the Democrats would say, great, DACA, here's the wall. I think they could do that. That was the deal on the table. It was only stopped because Trump wanted so much more that went along with that. So I think this actually could be something favorable if Ryan wants to be that guy. Otherwise, we'll just wait until next year, and depending on who's in control, might have a vote in January of 2019.
Julianne, could you see that happening?
I don't know. I know we'll have to wait and see. It's been so up and down. It's been such a roller coaster with regard to immigration. But I think that Charles is correct that there could have been a deal on the table with regard to the wall in exchange for DACA.
Mary Margaret?
Immigration is the most divisive issue within the Republican Party.
Yeah.
As I watch what happens in Georgia, of course not Washington, but I'm Georgia-focused, the 16 Republicans that are leaving politics in the House, 10 of whom are committee chairs, are very much between the inner and the outer perimeter where all of Georgia's future is going to be determined. Greg, you live between the inner and the outer perimeter. That's where the future of Georgia's politics is going to be decided. And immigration is a divisive, ugly issue where Republicans, and particularly Gwinnett, simply cannot vote for the meanness of the language that the President Trump utters on frequent basis on the immigration bill. It's the most divisive issue in my view, and perhaps it may be good politics for the Republican to resolve that issue before November, because it's the most festering issue. And we see it, to my fascination, in our state gubernatorial ads. Fascinating.
It's been remarkable that the ads that you've seen for the GOP gubernatorial side have been almost exclusively focused on immigration, right, using the most horrendous type of language. But there's a reason for that. I have a couple of friends that work in several different campaigns. The number one issue of GOP primary voters is illegal immigration. The number one issue by a lot. And so by seizing on this issue and seeing it, you are the one that's going to take care of it, even though governors have literally nothing to do with illegal immigration, maybe get you to the head of that pack. But I think you'd have to change your way of speaking very quickly come general election season.
Obviously, since November of 2016 election, I have even less, and I was pretty skeptical before, even less faith in polling. The Republicans I know, even in the House where there's a very conservative view of immigration among some, do not see it as politically helpful to them to deny workforce, deny the economics, deny the viability of our new citizens, who most of whom are finding their way fairly quickly into a workforce. The voter support for DACA's for the Dreamers is just, and the business support for protecting their workforce is just so strong that the politics of running far to the right, based on polling data of whom? Not the inner, the outer perimeter.
No, I agree.
Where every church is signed up, every church and synagogue is signed up for some program.
But if you're a Republican politician, the first post that you've got to pass is that primary electorate. Right, Julianne? That's kind of the first metric that you've got to meet.
That is true, and Chuck is correct that it does poll well among the base of the Republican Party. I would disagree slightly with regard to Gwinnett. I live in Gwinnett, and immigration, illegal immigration specifically, is something that I wouldn't say that people are not supportive of President Trump's stance on immigration. I would say that they are. I would say that the reason that Hillary Clinton won Gwinnett County is because of the changing demographics of Gwinnett, not because Republicans are not supportive of President Trump's immigration policies.
Well, I think that's a really good point, because that really gets to the issue of who's going to be voting in the general election.
Right.
You know, this is now we have a party where the most extreme candidate is going to be the candidate. How's that going to play, particularly in a county like Gwinnett, which is becoming, which is majority-minority. I forget exactly which way you say that. And where people are beginning to vote in much larger numbers than they have before. It's going to be a remarkable election season this year.
And that's why the general election contest is going to be so interesting, because whoever the Republican nominee and the Democratic nominee, there's going to be a vast gulf on not just immigration, but on budget, on expanding Medicaid, on Civil War monuments, on the death penalty, on gun control,
Hope whatever scholarships, all this
Hope
stuff.
Scholarship, yeah. Whatever the issue is, whereas in past elections, there was certainly a contrast, but not nearly as big of a contrast, let's say, between Governor Deal and Jason Carter as there will between Republican A and Democrat B. It's going to be enormous.
I think that the election coming up is fascinating. It's very much based on today's tensions and the divisiveness mm-hmm. that's come to politics. I'm influenced by what I saw as new energy in the 2018 session. 30,000 people coming out for March for Our Lives, 1,500 suburban mothers for Moms Demand Action, where the Republican leadership literally pulled the plug on the microphone that allowed them to speak, literally. I mean, physically pulled the plug so they couldn't speak. The newly elected people and all of the new faces in the Gold Dome to the Gold Dome about 452 that came down to lobby against.
And remind folks what 452 is.
452 was the anti-immigrant bill that made it to the day 40 mm-hmm. that was coalescing around.
And what did the bill do?
Well, it's fascinating. What did it do?
That's the question. Exactly. Right. It didn't really do a whole heck of a lot.
Can somebody just please, for people who don't know what the bill numbers are, just give them a pricey of what it is.
The key focus of the bill was to detain people who were supposedly undocumented immigrants for however long it took for ICE to show up and pick them up.
Right.
And honestly, it's stupid because under federal law, that already happens. In the federal law, when you are arrested anywhere in Georgia, ICE is alerted immediately. And within minutes, if ICE wants you, an immigration hold is put into place. And in Georgia, not supposed to release that person for 48 hours. ICE is honestly way more efficient today than it's ever been. They are at virtually every jail within 48 hours to pick that person up.
I follow this issue. Of course, the bail and bond issue in 452 is something I was following closely because that's an important issue to those of us that are watching the criminal justice reform. And Governor Deal, one more time, set forth a very good pattern about we're going to try to fix in a significant way the issue of if you owe a $200 fine or a $100 bail and that barrier makes you sit in jail for 60 days at the expense of the taxpayer, we're going to fix that.
Mm-hmm.
And 452 moved back on that. Of course, I'm sensitive to all this because of Decatur.
Right.
Decatur has a closet, a holding cell that Lieutenant Governor Cagle is having this complete fit over, calling it a sanctuary city. They don't even have a jail.
All right, we're going to let Greg get a final thought in. Then we got to take a break.
Oh, yeah, I was saying this is what is also underlying the surprisingly productive session that we just ended. Because of what Mary Margaret Oliver said earlier, there are 16 Republicans retiring. There's, two dozen or so competitive House seats. So Republicans who are looking at facing tough re-election contests, some of them for the first time ever against Democratic opponents, at least, knew they had to have something productive on the table. And also, I think that also played into some of these bills that could be viewed as discriminatory getting killed in the final hours.
There are 27 House seats out of 180 that are held by Republicans that were won by Hillary Clinton.
Okay. And with that, we are going to bring a pause to this part of the program because we have got so much more to talk about in the next few minutes or so. We're going to talk about Atlanta politics. We're going to talk about the raid of Trump's lawyer's office. We're going to talk maybe about Syria as well, if we can get to that. Who knows what news is going to break in the next few minutes, and we'll have to drop everything for that as well. We hope you'll stay with us, and you're listening to Political Rewind on GPB.
GPB Spring Fund Drive starts soon, but the time to give is now. Your contribution at gpb.org before the drive starts will do twice the good. You'll support the programs you enjoy, and your gift will be part of our challenge fund to inspire others to join you in supporting GPB. You'll also have a chance to win a St. Simons Island getaway to the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. Please go to gpb.org and click donate, and thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk about the escalating trade dispute between the U.S. and China and the possible consequences with Robert Kuttner, author of the new book, Can Democracy Survive Global Capitalism? And we'll discuss the connection he sees between global capitalism and the rise of the far right in the U.S. and abroad. Join us.
Fresh Air is this afternoon at 3 here on GPB.
You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB, and welcome back as well to those of you watching on Facebook Live. I'm Bradley George, and for Bill Nigut, today we're talking with AJC political journalist Greg Bluestein, immigration attorney Charles Cook, Democratic State Representative Mary Margaret Oliver, and GOP strategist Julianne Thompson. Now, we've been talking a lot about national politics and state politics. Let's talk about the city of Atlanta for a minute, because, oh boy, has there been so much going on with Atlanta city government the last couple of weeks. And this week, we have the mayor of Atlanta, Keisha Lance Bottoms. She has asked for the resignations of most of her cabinet members. We know that her communications director and her chief financial director have reportedly already resigned. She says she will not accept all resignations. And all of this follows another indictment late last week on corruption in City Hall involving someone, Greg Bluestein, that worked in Kasim Reed's administration.
Yeah, and there's a couple, there's three or four elements kind of in the background of this. There's the massive cyber attack and the city's, tough response to that. It wasn't the quickest response. It took days for the Wi-Fi at the Atlanta airport to be turned back on. City workers couldn't even turn their computers on for several days. There's the ongoing federal corruption probe that has now netted several indictments. And there's the open records issues that are still lingering with Mayor Reed and Mayor Reed's former spokeswoman, who is also briefly on Keisha Bottoms' team, having been exposed texting another coworker saying essentially, hold back, don't release these records. So all those, plus you have a new mayor who did in the final weeks of her campaign for office, try to distance herself from Mayor Reed. She didn't want to be looked like as a third term of Mayor Reed, who did say early on, day three or four, she asked a lot of her top advisors, a lot of the top officials who are hanging over, you might not stay long. Give me 100 days to look through this. Now we're at day 90-something. Mm-hmm. And she did formally ask them all to return in the resignations. We'll find out in the next couple of days whether or not she's accepting many of them. I have a feeling she's going to accept a decent amount of them, but I don't think there will be a complete overhaul.
And these are people, too, because Kasim Reed served two terms. These are folks who've had long tenures in city government.
Some of them, and some of them were hires during his last year.
Right.
A few of them I can think of were hired in the last 6 or 7 months of his stint of his second term. And some of them are very close to Mayor Bottoms. So she'll probably leave some of those on. But yeah, there's a few that might just use this as an excuse to leave because they were already kind of had one foot out of the door.
Mary Margaret Oliver, was this a smart move by Mayor Bottoms?
It was a smart move, and it was a timely move. I don't think she should have. It would have. It's more effective to me for her to spend 90 plus days prior to 100 days getting to know a little bit more, getting her feet under the ground, and then making this move at this time. I thought it was strategically smart. I am most curious, and I don't know the answer to this, really, who is really influencing her on these kinds of questions and these kind of issues. The communications director that made one of the mistakes that I see every young, middle-aged, and old lawyer make of saying something in email that is Facebook that's almost career-ending.
Yep.
I teach ethics classes occasionally in various ways and to young lawyers and law students, and 2/3 of every conversation is about email and Facebook and how you can end your career immediately.
Mm-hmm.
So what is Keisha? That's significant that she took this strategic opportunity at the right time, I think, to look at a change. And then the other question is, does she know, which I don't know, where did Mitzi Bickers' $2 million go? Did Mitzi Bickers put all of it in her pocket, or did it flow through to other people?
Greg, remind folks who Mitzi Bickers is.
Yeah, she is a former aide to Mayor Reed, one of the who was involved in his campaign for reelection, who is also sort of known as a get out the vote expert, who helped kind of pound the pavement to get voters. And she last week, was sentenced. Was it sentenced?
No, she was indicted.
She was indicted. I'm sorry. She was indicted. She was indicted. She's also a pastor.
A pastor. She is been a very high-ticket political consultant. And is she still chaplain to the Clayton County Jail?
I'm not sure about that, but we actually sent a reporter to her church on Sunday, and we had an interesting article about how her flock is rallying behind her. So this isn't over yet, too. But we also heard from BJ Pack, the U.S. attorney, saying if there are anyone else who knows where this money is going, who has any more information, now is your chance to come forward.
Is this your window?
Here's your window. Here's your sort of amnesty period.
Follow the money. Follow the money.
And I guess that's the thing here, Julianne Thompson, is that we don't, in terms of the folks who have been indicted in this scandal, we don't know where the end is. There could be more shoes to drop or more dominoes to fall.
Yeah, we don't know how high it goes. And it's interesting to note about Mitzi Bickers. One of the things in particular that she was in trouble for is steering $5 million to a snow removal contractor that didn't own any snowplows. I mean, it just reeks of corruption and impropriety. And I admire and commend Mayor Bottoms for the moves that she made. I think they were politically smart. I think that most of the people at this table know William Perry, and William Perry has been talking about this.
Former director of Common Cause. Yeah.
Yes, and he has been talking about the corruption within the Reid administration for the past 8 years. He's gotten a lot of flack because of it. Mayor Reid has said a lot of very negative things about William Perry, and he finally left Common Cause, and now Mayor Bottoms is asking the executive director of Common Cause to bring a person from Common Cause into the transition panel to look at ethics and changes that the government can make. So I think that's an interesting turn of events.
Why does this keep happening in Atlanta? Why do we keep having this administration after administration after administration? Are people not getting paid enough money, or do they want to be rich off sucking off the government teat? I mean, why does this keep happening? That's the root cause of the problem here. Why do people like this keep getting into government?
I do not accept the premise that it happens in Atlanta in more or less frequency.
Oh, I agree. I think other city governments
County
as well.
And DeKalb County. I don't know how many of your commissioners had to go to the penitentiary in the last 10 years. Several.
A couple.
Yeah.
So premise one, is it right or wrong? Premise two, there's just so much money flowing around. And I see people, lawyers, I think about my lawyer colleagues, who take money out of a trust account and in their career in ways that's totally inexplicable.
It's just, that's the stunning part. Is that, surely there are lots of honest politicians out there. Honest, good people.
I think so.
Why are they not reporting this when they see it? Maybe they're not. Maybe these people are so sneaky they're hiding it well. But then to the average citizen, that's the problem. That's what they view government as corrupt, when I think there may be a few people in it that are corrupt, but they give a bad reputation to everybody else.
And I think a lot of it goes down to controls and transparency. And I think that's why it'll be really interesting to see over the next few months how Mayor Bottoms yesterday announced this new transparency initiative, where there's basically computer programs and apps that voters can see contracts, see what was doled out to certain agencies in order to clean the streets, in order to remove snow, whatever it might be, who is behind that. It'll be interesting to see exactly how in-depth that will go and if that will lead to substantive changes to how Atlanta operates.
And it doesn't cover what goes on behind the scenes.
No.
Right.
I mean, there's nothing you can do about that, and that's where most corruption occurs, is behind the scenes. And it's not a Democrat problem. It's not a Republican problem. It's a human problem, and it's something that we're dealing with in Atlanta, all across Georgia, and all across the country.
So, it's interesting because I think back to the mayoral election, and particularly in the runoff, where Kasim Reed made it clear that Keisha Lance Bottoms was his preferred candidate. And it seems like now, not only is she trying to sort of present herself as her own mayor, as her own person, But in a way, she's kind of having to clean up the mess that Reid left behind in some ways, right?
Yeah, and she did make corruption and transparency a really big part of the last few months of the campaign, especially as she started keeping her predecessor at arm's length. But he also made it very clear that she was his favorite candidate. He showed up at her election parties. He campaigned for her very vigorously. Was with helped lure high profile surrogates in town for her. She essentially has to prove for the next 6 months that she's not Kasim Reid 3.0.
I don't think the city of Atlanta had a very good session in the General Assembly. They lost the Beltline bill. Yep. And got into this dispute on Mitchell Street, which I followed. I was kind
of state control of the airport kind state, of right. came
I
back
was
up.
Kind of unhappy about several different moves. She has a tough job following a mayor who was a bully and who was authoritarian and who took. Shirley Franklin had a tougher job. Shirley Franklin following the corruption of Bill Campbell, probably a tougher job. The jury's out on Keisha Lance Bottoms. She's presenting herself well. I see her doing some smart things. The web-based, let's follow the money, give mm-hmm. every nerd in Georgia a chance to follow every check. There will be people who will spend a lot of time
and think about that.
She's doing some right things. Whether she's bringing in the right people, that's what we'll see. She has a brand new chief of staff from business, a brand new COO from business, neither of whom have had political backgrounds. What does that mean? What's the transition going to look like? We don't really know yet.
All right, so let's move on. Let's talk about some congressional races, particularly the 6th District, where Republican Karen Handel is the incumbent. Is that your district, Charles?
That's my district.
That's your district. Okay.
Yes. He actually was thinking about running last year.
Oh, right. I was. Then I had my brain put back in my head.
You know, it's funny. I was thinking the other day. It was It's about a year. It's been about a year since the since the runoff, right?
The first round. Yeah, a year and it was April 18th.
So we're about a year and a week off. Wow. Time flies, doesn't it, when you're having fun? So Karen Handel is trying to hold on to that seat in November, and she has a number of Democratic challengers who are hoping to take that seat from her. One of them is Lucy McBath. She wrote a recent op-ed piece for Vanity Fair. She's become well-known as a gun control advocate after her teenage son was shot by a white man after quarreling over the volume of music playing in his car. She says his death and school shootings inspired her to run. She's also running on a platform to improve women's health care. And then we have Bobby Caple, who's the former was a former anchor on CBS 46. And he recently released his first TV ad.
This is Camden, and this is Alice. Happy, healthy kids. But that wasn't guaranteed. I'm Bobby Caple, and I'm their dad. Camden and Alice were preemies, a little over 3 pounds each. But they got bigger. It cost hundreds of thousands of dollars to keep them alive. Thank God for Obamacare. I approve this message because there isn't one reason why I'll stop Donald Trump from repealing health care in Congress. There are two.
Thank God for Obamacare.
That's a tough platform to be running on in the 6th District.
Yeah,
it's going to be
against a incumbent Republican.
If you look at
what my view is the
two most divisive and topical issues of immigration and guns, mm-hmm. The 6th District is not an anti-guns district.
It's not.
It's not an anti-immigration district.
It's not.
And you have this national focus on Ms. McBath, who is a national story. She's very effective on the platform. She's charismatic, I'll go that far. And Karen Handel is going to have a tough time hiding from the gun and hiding from the immigration issue in the 6th Congressional District. Has Karen Handel said one word since April 18th?
Well, she has.
Yeah.
Although she's never answered my tweets on immigration or DACA because she has not taken any position on those issues since she's been elected.
And she's managed to avoid a Republican challenger, which would have been really, could have been really difficult for her. She stockpiled a lot of money. She was just in town with Speaker Ryan not so long ago. She went with Donald Trump to one of his rallies in Pittsburgh for that failed Republican candidate in that special election. So she's kind of making the rounds, and she's become somewhat of a counselor to other Republicans in competitive races, because everyone's asking her, how did you win the most expensive U.S. House election in history? And she'll say to many of them, focus on Nancy Pelosi, because that's what she did here in the 6th District. It wasn't the thrust of her message, but it was a big part of it, was Nancy Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi, Nancy Pelosi. And Ossoff really failed to have a reasonable answer to that. He would never say whether or not he supported Pelosi or not. He always said, we'll cross that bridge. I'm too busy with my own race. And you're already seeing now Democratic candidates, including several in the 6th District, come out early and say, no, I will not support Nancy Pelosi, because they don't want the same thing to happen to them that happened to Ossoff last year.
Well, we're also seeing Republicans use the specter of impeaching Donald Trump as kind of with that same kind of attack that they were using with Nancy Pelosi last year. Julianne.
Well, I was just going to follow up on what Mary Margaret said. I don't think Karen Handel should hide from her Second Amendment stances. It is not an anti-gun district. I think that she should be proud of her support of the Second Amendment. And and with regard to Bobby's ad on Obamacare, I don't see the district as being a big pro-Obamacare district either. I'll say this about Bobby. We've talked about the other Democratic challenger. Of course, I'm 100% in support of Karen Handel, but Bobby's a nice guy. And, mm-hmm. To meet Bobby and to have a conversation with him is to like him. So as far as retail politics are concerned, the other Democratic challenger in this race that we were talking about before, although I believe that she is in this for purely personal and idealistic reasons, which I admire her for, even though I disagree with the outcome of where she's going with it, she's going to have a difficult time outdoing Bobby in retail politics and meeting people one-on-one, because he's a really nice guy.
Yeah, the other candidate, and one of the other candidates is Kevin Abel. Mm-hmm. Also an immigrant. I mean, I got to speak for the immigrants. Mm-hmm. Yeah, immigrants, immigrant from South Africa, been in the U.S. 25 years, super successful business owner, wants to give back to the country that gave him an opportunity. Also, like Bobby, very friendly, very open. I think he's really good at retail politics, is able to raise funds. I think it's going to be a really interesting race. I don't see McBath as having any chance in the 6th, honestly. Nobody knows who she is. I talked to my neighbors, literally they have never heard of her.
Each one of these candidates running in the Democratic primary are strong.
Right,
they have
I agree.
Strengths to it. Each one of those are going to bring a more thoughtful discussion to a primary election year in this particular year than usual. I think it's going to be a very positive influence on the Sixth Amendment. Let me say something about the Second Amendment, the message, Second Amendment versus the message assault weapon. I have for 3 years been the legislator that introduced a ban on assault weapon in the Georgia General Assembly. So I have followed this issue closely and personally because of the 2,000 hate mails and various threats against me coming from the NRA. And I am fascinated by the change of tone. If the horror of Parkland and the emergence of the youth leadership had happened 2 months earlier, hypothetically, the tenor of the Georgia General Assembly would not have been overtly hostile to the word assault weapon. I think if you did an intelligent polling focus group stuff, which I'm not sure you could do on this issue, and you put out the word assault weapon and you put out the word Second Amendment, how does that play and how people respond today, April 11th, 2018?
And how do you define assault weapon? That's the other thing, is that I think that there needs to be a more clear definition of what an assault weapon actually is.
There are two go-to defenses to when you use any kind of language about high-capacity magazines. There are two traditional Republican defenses. One, what's assault weapon? In the 1934 federal legislation that banned machine guns, it was a discussion of the definition. That's the first place. The second place they go is Mary Margaret doesn't know anything about guns, so we don't have to listen to her. Those are the two traditional It's the two traditional ways that people respond to assault weapon politics.
Well, I'm truly asking what the definition of an assault weapon is. I'm not trying to use that as any sort of political tool. I'm truly asking because you can ask five different people and get five different answers.
In House Bill 10, the definition of assault weapon is about a page and a half, and historically on this legislation, it has emerged as the central meat of every kind of bill that's put forward. And the definition that I'm using in a page and a half comes from following the technology and has been upheld by the 7th, the 2nd, and the 4th Circuit Court appellate to uphold the opportunity for states to pass assault weapon bans as defined by a page and a half.
And just like last year's 6th District race was cast nationally as a litmus test on Trump in conservative-leaning suburbs, this race could be cast, if depending on who's the Democratic nominee, as a litmus test on guns in the conservative-leaning suburbs. Because Lucy McBath, you might not have heard of her too much in the district, and I live in the district too, but she managed to raise six figures in East Cobb County to challenge Sam Teasley, an incumbent Republican who probably, I mean, that was going to be a really, he still has a competitive race, but that was going to be a really tough fight for him. And she got in the race the week of qualifying, the Tuesday of qualifying, she got in the race. So she's a very late to the party here, whereas Abel and Capel both got in late last year. So they've been in for months. So she's a proven fundraiser, but she is also, her main issue is guns.
She's a national candidate.
Yeah.
She's a national
candidate.
So
you're going to hear guns, guns, guns. She'll embrace other Democratic traditional messages, but guns is her core message. So that really could kind of focus the race on firearms.
I think at the end of the day, Karen has a very hard time defending her seat. The race against John Ossoff was a race against a guy with no political experience who didn't live in the district, who became Nancy Pelosi. That's not going to be, whoever the candidate is not going to be that candidate this time. You've got people with long tenure in the district, and there are a lot of Republicans who do not like Karen Handel. A lot of them. There was a lot of rumblings of people running against her in primaries for this time. They all said, the three that I talked to was, we're not sure we could win the district even if we beat her in a primary, given the changing demographics in the six. It's going to be a very tight race, and Karen's not going to have $32 million again. She may have raised money now, but a lot of that money is going to a lot of other races.
But to be fair,
country.
She only had, it was less than 10. It was Ossoff who had 32.
Yeah. Yeah. I was going to say, I think Ossoff outspent her 4-5-1.
It was a huge amount of money that came in.
Ossoff didn't just automatically do well in that district. He had millions and millions of dollars coming from all across the country to his race. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think it's fair to just say it was just a regular district race, Ossoff against Handel. I mean, this had national implications, and we'll see if it does again.
So
And Trump is a lot different in 2018 than he was in April 2017.
So is the 6th, is that the closest we get to a competitive congressional race in Georgia this year?
Well, I'm really curious about the Woodall race.
Yeah.
I'm really curious about that. I see a lot of a number, like the 6th and the Woodall district. There are a number of very strong Democratic contenders. I think it's a more Republican seat, I'm guessing, than Karen Handel's seat.
Oh, yeah.
But it's suburban.
It's suburban, but it's northwest Gwinnett and Forsyth County.
Half of Forsyth, which was a
and
huge
the half
Trump.
Of Forsyth yeah. that encompasses Cumming, and it is a very Republican district. I do not see that as a competitive district for Democrats. A
number of immigrants running in
district.
That seat as well.
There are at least two immigrants running for that seat, and half a dozen Democrats. So
Bordeaux,
I
like Bordeaux as a candidate. She's to me, a highly qualified suburban type.
Tell us more about this.
Well, she's a Lady Bordeaux who came out of a lot of government financial issues, and she's getting a lot of play, I think.
There's a lot of groundwork being done in Gwinnett. Ethan Pham's running very aggressively up there. He's knocking a lot of doors.
David Kim, Steve Riley. There's a lot of candidates out there. So a lot of it depends on which one emerges.
You're going to get a lot of mail if you live in Gwinnett County, is all I can tell you.
And it's true, too, because there's a number of state seats that are open up there as well. So it's going to be ground zero for a lot of competitive races.
That's the home of Representative Oliver mentioned, at least two dozen seats held by Republicans that Clinton won.
27.
Well, 27. Yeah. Well, there's five or six in Gwinnett. There's several in Cobb. There's several in North Fulton and in DeKalb as well. So Gwinnett is that's also the home of several retiring Republican
lawmakers. Brooks Coleman.
Wendell Willard.
Willard's in Fulton.
But understand that Gwinnett, all of Gwinnett, is not part of the 7th. Only the northwest portion of Gwinnett is part of the 7th. Gwinnett encompasses the 10th, the 7th, and the 4th. And I think that most of the Republicans in the 7th district and the 10th district are safe. And it will be interesting to see who does well in district House District 97's primary, which is Brooks Coleman's primary. Mm-hmm. I'm actually moderating a debate for the Republican primary candidates next week. So.
And Congressman Woodall said it himself to the AJC last year. He said, if my district was just Gwinnett, I wouldn't be here. Mm-hmm. But because it's only a portion of Gwinnett and it has that very deep red part of Forsyth County, it really helps buffer him. And this was a district Trump won in 16 by, I think, 4 or 5 points. It wasn't nearly as close as the 6th district, which he only won by 1.5.
All right, we're going to take another break here. We're also going to remind you tomorrow night, Bill and the crew will be in Macon at Mercer Medical School Auditorium, 7 o'clock. Tickets are free. You can get them at gpb.org/community. That's gpb.org/community to see Political Rewind live in Macon tomorrow night. Hope you can make it. If you're in Middle Georgia, do try to attend if you can. When we come back in the remaining minutes, we're going to talk about Mark Zuckerberg's testimony on Capitol Hill and some other things as well. You're listening to Political Rewind on GPB.
It's not every day you have the chance to inspire someone else and have your gift go even further for a cause that's important to you. But today is the day. Support GPB now at gpb.org, and your contribution will be part of our challenge fund to encourage others to join you in supporting GPB during our spring fund drive. With other sources of funding in question, take this opportunity now to inspire others to join you in support of public radio. That's gpb.org, and thanks.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind on GPB. Thanks as well for watching. If you're checking us out on Facebook Live, we're on the GPB News Facebook page. You can watch us there every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 2 o'clock. Mark Zuckerberg, Greg Bluestein just told me, is in his fifth hour of testimony on Capitol Hill. Today, he's testifying in front of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. And one of the members of that committee is Congressman Buddy Carter from Savannah. And he spoke to GPB News earlier this week about what he would be asking Zuckerberg during that hearing, and also sort of his thoughts on possibly regulating Facebook.
I believe that less government is better government, and I don't want us to have to regulate this industry. The less regulation, I think, the better off they will be. I hope the message that he gets is that you get it straight before we have to get it straight for you.
And now Greg Bluestein, Mark Zuckerberg, one of the things he said this morning is that regulation of Facebook might be inevitable.
Yeah, he seems a little bit open to more regulation. And he's getting the grilling he's getting today is on that. It's on privacy settings, and it's on whether or not he considers Facebook a monopoly. So there's a lot of questions about whether or not the government can intervene if it would classify Facebook as a monopoly. Zuckerberg is trying to push back very hard on that he's getting a lot more tougher grilling than he did yesterday in the Senate on that issue in particular, saying, look, there's competition. There's other social media. It might not be the same as Facebook, but there are other outlets out there that are trying to work in the same space as Facebook.
But Facebook keeps purchasing them.
Right.
Yeah, well, they don't have the maybe Bell's, Facebook, maybe right. Facebook's are going to break up Facebook and have regional Facebooks.
I watched Senator Lindsey question Mr. Zuckerberg yesterday on the issue of who's your competition. And it was very interesting because Zuckerberg did not want to say I'm there is no competition. Mm-hmm. And there was a discussion back and forth about the other apps, and it's a moving target. This is a technology and a business and an engineering phenomena that's a moving target that I don't think anybody's capable of keeping up with. But Facebook, with 2 billion people participating, has to be more able to keep up with it than you and me.
And remember, China doesn't have Facebook. So, I mean,
they have their own version of Baidu, exactly,
but not Facebook. So, Matt, you could add another billion people to that if Facebook was over there.
And just a stat on that, Facebook owns 3 of the top 10 mobile apps used in the U.S. That's Facebook, Facebook Messenger, and Instagram.
Yep.
And they own WhatsApp, which is used in a lot of other countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, throughout Latin America, WhatsApp is the primary app people use. Yeah.
And the smart people questioned yesterday were about what is the regulation climate in Europe? And is that something we can... Regulations are happening internationally. What's the smartest direction for us to go in? Because it has to... We have to protect more than we're protecting now. I think there's a consensus on that.
We certainly got to protect our children. I mean, that's just a reality.
And protect our elections.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. I just hope you got better questions today than yesterday. I mean, I'm really, you should at least have to use Facebook to ask questions.
I enjoyed yesterday. I enjoyed, on both sides of the aisle, I enjoyed it when Dick Durbin said, are you comfortable? Are you comfortable telling us where you stayed, what hotel you stayed at last night? And Zuckerberg said, well, no. And he said, well, are you comfortable with telling us who you've messaged in the past several hours? He said, no, Senator. And he said, well, that's what we're here to talk about today. Other people are not comfortable with their privacy or lack thereof either. And then Ted Cruz eviscerated him yesterday, and he was unable really. He actually avoided answering just about every question that Cruz had for him with regard to censorship.
I assume there's fewer than 43 people today questioning Zuckerberg. The committee's much smaller, I would imagine. Than
well, it's a House committee, so it's...
Yeah, well, could have been 17. Yeah, no way there's 43 people asking the questions again.
Usually they're larger. But I guess what, you know, these hearings, they make headlines, they get a lot of attention. But what comes after this? You know, what's the tangible thing that comes... That's going to come out of this? Is it regulation? Is it something? Is Facebook going to make changes? Like what's coming after?
Well, I think there's zero chance Congress does anything. They're not doing anything. I mean, why would they act on this?
What I would really like to see Facebook do is make people opt in rather than opt out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that would help solve a lot of problems with privacy issues.
And he was asked about that by Representative Frank Pallone of a New Jersey Democrat. And Zuckerberg's answer is, this is a complex issue that deserves more than a one-word answer.
My people will get back to you.
So essentially, yeah. And I guess Facebook will be under the gun to make those changes before being compelled to make them by Congress if they do act.
But it's also their choice. I mean, they've kind of become sort of, it's sort of an opt-in thing by default, right? You have to go in, and in some instances, they make it very difficult to go in and change some of these settings to share some of this information, either with your friends or with some of these apps and some of these analytics that can be problematic.
I was trying to change a setting recently and following directions of online about something, and the notice online was only a month old, and the settings had been changed. It's just amazing. Yep. I think Facebook makes the change when people start leaving. And they see market share decreasing or user numbers decrease. That's when I think Facebook will feel like, oh, why is this happening? We have to make a change.
In our closing minute, Mary Margaret Oliver, I've got a question for you about this, because Facebook's just broken ground on a new data center in Social Circle. The state's trying to recruit Amazon for its second headquarters. We've got all these tech companies that are moving into Midtown, NCR, and other companies that are over here just across the connector from us here at GPP. What are the questions that state officials, people like you, need to be asking, do you think? What are you curious to know from companies about Facebook and Amazon, about the effects not only that they're going to have on users, but they're going to have on the communities in which they're doing business?
I hope that somebody in economic development is asking those questions. The only questions that are being asked now are how many jobs you bring and how much money do we have to give you to bring those jobs. I think that the tech industry has been leading the increase of the stock market. It has been the reason that we've had this kind of... There's a lot of questions not being asked is the only response I can give you.
Okay, and we will have to leave it there. Mary Margaret Oliver, Julianne Thompson, Charles Cook, Greg Bluestein, thank you all so much for joining us. And thank you for listening to Political Rewind Wednesday afternoon. Thanks for watching on Facebook Live. I'm Bradley George, and for Bill Nygut. Thanks again.